Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court. We are here today to review a grant of qualified immunity that was entered against Mr. Chocolas and Mr. Wiss by the District Court. The fundamental question, let me backtrack. The District Court, in performing the Saucier analysis, got the first prong correct. The Court very clearly concluded that the defendants had retaliated against my clients based upon protected speech. The District Court stumbled a little bit when it got to the second prong of the Saucier analysis. And in the second prong, the Court concluded that it was not clear that their actions would have violated.
You won't be able to skip the merits completely because, of course, the appellee has defended its judgment by arguing that the District Court erred on that issue. You may choose to get to it later, but I hope you will be getting to it.
I certainly will, Judge Easterbrook, and certainly welcome any questions on the specific merits because there are a number of different issues there. But what I would like to say first on the second prong of the qualified immunity analysis is the court came back with essentially two justifications. The first was it wasn't clear that they had a right to write this letter. Well, And really what the court looked at was was case law authority and said, look, there's no case law out there. But the Illinois statutes and the administrative code that has been promulgated essentially make that right very clear.
Well, yeah, I got worried when you said that. And that it sounds like what you're trying to do is use 1983 to enforce in federal court a right under state law. But what rights they have under state law is a question of state law. There's no federal rule that states have to follow their own law.
Well, no, there isn't. But the question is this protected speech? And determining, and this I guess we get back to the merits of the case in assessing whether there is protected speech, the first prong that we look to.
One reason why the Supreme Court thought it might be a good idea to start there, although perhaps they'll overrule that decision this year.
It's up for debate, I know, in the Supreme Court.
Let me tell you what worries me on that theme. And do you have any difficulty with the proposition that states and the federal government, for that matter, can control moonlighting by their employees? There are limits on what judges can do for moonlighting, for example, and it's pretty common.
Well, as an overarching theoretical possibility, I suppose. I think that we have to look at the...
I take it that the state could say no state employee can do business with the state through a corporation he owns.
That would certainly be a reasonable restriction.
Yeah. Well, what you had here is a state that allows its employees to moonlight to some degree.
Some degree.
But curtails their ability to moonlight. And what you're describing is the state's effort to strike this middle ground as a violation of the First Amendment. Isn't that a little tough?
Well, I don't think that's what we're trying to do, Judge Easterbrook. I think that we are not saying that the state does not have a right to restrict their ability to engage in secondary employment. That's not what we are saying. We are saying that the state cannot restrict their right to object to a procurement policy. That the state is very clear.
Why not? That's part of the restriction on moonlighting.
No, it's not. That is not correct. There is the restriction on moonlighting, and the OEIG report made it very, very clear. All that they did was oppose the procurement. There was a procurement. The way that the system works, once a procurement decision has been made, it must be posted on the State of Illinois website. After that period of time, anyone has a period of 14 days in which to object.
But at the very least, isn't that letter what we might call a hybrid?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When you say a hybrid,
to shift the contract from them mm-hmm. to us.
That, well, Judge Easterbrook and Judge Rovner, to answer the combined question, the way that this court has consistently looked at First Amendment cases is, are they, when assessing whether it's a matter of public concern, are these statements purely personal, or is there some public concern element? And that is where the district court got it correct. The public policy of the state of Illinois is that procurement be done in the most economical and beneficial way to the members of the state. These two individuals, Chocolas and Wist, complained.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question.
Absolutely, Judge Easterbrook.
Suppose an Air Force officer who is involved in the award of the tanker contract, which I assume you've been following the news, you know there's a big fight between Boeing and Lockheed about who is going to build the next generation of tankers. Suppose an Air Force officer thinks that the award should have gone to Boeing, and in fact it goes to Lockheed. You think the Air Force officer could then file a contract bid protest without any response by the Air Force in an effort to foul up the award that his supervisors had made?
Well, without knowing the specifics, Your Honor,
I'm giving you all that's necessary. I will make it worse later by saying, and suppose this officer has secret holdings in Boeing, because then it'll get worse. Your client is in the worst position because they've got holdings in the competitor.
Well,
but let's just start with the first position. Could the federal government say to the people involved in the contract procurement process, you follow the process through to its end, and then your involvement in it is done? You can't say, now I'm a member of the general public, and I'm going to try to foul up the grant that my bureau just made.
Well, I think by getting to that, you're really addressing the second prong of the Pickering-Connick analysis.
I'm addressing the first question, which is whether it is within the constitutional power of the government to say to its employees, once a bid has been let, the members of this bureau can't try to foul it up.
Well, I disagree with the analysis, because I think that the first prong would be the Garcetti analysis that you are referring to, Judge Easterbrook. And under Garcetti, what the Supreme Court said was that the governing government employer has a right to punish its employees for engaging in a speech that was made pursuant to their job duties.
I'm having a little bit of a problem understanding why Garcetti is applicable at all. I mean, the state says that as public employees, Mr. Chocolas and Mr. Wist had an obligation to report anti-competitive practices, but that's not really what the protest letter was. The theory is entirely contrary to the notion that they were doing something improper when they filed the protest, which is why they were disciplined.
Well, I certainly agree with your Garcetti analysis, Judge Rovner, and I think that, you know, to take it one step further, you were correct in your opinion that you wrote, the concurring opinion that you wrote in Morales, was whether it is the kind of, on Garcetti, whether it is the kind of activity engaged in by persons who do not work for the government.
Right.
And this protest bid, this is not something that they only made because they were employed by the government. Anybody in the state of Illinois
could have launched that protest bid.
Well, I apologize.
It was a protest.
I hope it wasn't a bid. It was not a bid. It was not a bid. It was a protest. And that's what the letter says. That's what the OEIG found, that this letter was a protest to the sole sourcing of this particular contract. So if I use the word protest bid, I apologize. I mischaracterized what it is. But I think that post-Garcetti, this court and a number of other circuits have said that the Garcetti analysis becomes the first analysis, or the first prong of the First Amendment analysis. And I think that for the reasons you just indicated, Judge Rovner, the first prong is inapplicable here, which gets us to the second prong, Judge Easterbrook, which becomes whether this is a matter of public concern. And I think that the district court was correct.
I just think that this puts the whole question wrongly. If you agree with me that the federal government can prevent people who have an interest in one bidder from participating in the bidding process, and by the way, the tanker contract was raised because one of the people involved in the bidding process did, in fact, have an interest in Boeing, and she's now in prison.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It is within the power of government to stop people who have a financial interest in one of the bidders from participating in any way in this process. And if that's within the power of government, then I can't see what's wrong with what the state did here. It stopped somebody who had a financial interest in the bidding process and is also an employee of the state from participating in a particular way in that process.
This wasn't the bidding process, Judge Easterbrook. It was
Trying to get an award set aside is part of the process. The person who is now in jail because of her role in the Boeing contract would not have been in a better position if she waited for the contract to be let and then tried to have it set aside. It was a crime for someone who was employed by the government to try to influence the contract to in the direction of an entity in which you had a financial interest.
Well,
and your clients have financial interests in MFS.
Well, they certainly do.
What evidence suggests that the defendants really had no genuine concern about an ethical violation, and this was just a pretext for retaliation?
Well, you can look at what happened on the other end, Judge Rovner. When it came to them, and the OEIG writes this scathing report, finding
that's the opinion of the report's authors.
No, but let me...
I mean, in what sense does the report show that the defendant had no honest concern about the ethics of the plaintiff's protest letters?
Well, the honesty of them. First of all, they had a right to file the protest for two reasons. Number one, they did have secondary employment. They did have secondary employment with MFS. That was something that they had. They had the right to engage in that business. So we are not talking about someone who is in a clandestine manner ignoring this. You know, the reports had been put together outlining their interests in MFS, and those were very clear. And under ISP policy, they had been, you have to submit your secondary employment requests. Once you do, if they are either approved, they are denied, or they're not acted on. If they're not acted on within a period of 5 days, then the secondary request is granted. That's what the policy states. In this particular case, their first-level supervisor approved it, and then no other action was taken on it. It wasn't rejected. So the state of Illinois had given them the right to engage in this type of conduct. And I think that what happened on the other end is instructive, because when you're talking about what happened with Mr. Shepa, what the allegations that the OEIG, which is a statutory body set up in the wake of the Ryan scandals to investigate wrongdoing in state government, the OEIG very clearly comes out and says Mr. Shepa engaged in multiple infractions. These same people who disciplined my clients for the supposed ethical lapses do nothing with Mr. Shepo. They don't go to him and say, we want him investigated. They don't suspend him. They do nothing. And so if they are absolutely convinced that, you know, there are ethical lapses that have to be disciplined, then they would have followed the same protocol with Mr. Shepo, which they did not. And in my perspective, I think that creates a very viable issue of fact as to whether they genuinely believed that these were ethical violations, or whether their concern was Mr. Shepo was about to get a sweetheart deal for his company, and they put a hitch in the road. So that's the way I look at that. Unless there are any more immediate questions, I'd like to reserve some for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Baker.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Illinois Assistant Attorney General Carl Elitz for the state defendants. Mr. Baker, may it please the court.
Do you think we should start with Mr. Shepo and his conflict of interest, and why isn't there at least a factual question as to his good faith?
I think the question about Mr. Shepo's involvement in what happened here isn't really relevant to the constitutional rights, whether they exist or not. It might be relevant down the road when the plaintiffs have to establish that the retaliation that they allege is tied to their speech, and then they can set up a comparable and they can use, perhaps, they can use Mr. Shepo as that comparable employee.
Except sort of, you know, I mean, there are those cases like McGreal that say that if the defendants were not genuinely concerned about the disruptive effects of the plaintiff's speech, but really just wanted to, you know, punish the plaintiffs for the content of the speech, then they're not entitled to protection under Pickering or to qualified immunity. I mean, like if a jury were presented with all of the facts that were before the OEIG, could it find that one or more of these defendants, Mr. Shepo, for example, weren't sincerely concerned about the ethical ramifications of the
I don't
letter.
Believe so, Your Honors. My clients, in this case, turned over the question of the ethical conduct to two different entities who are not defendants and are independent here. One is the legal department of the state police. The state police came back with a finding that there was unethical violations here. And then it was turned over to the internal affairs divisions of the state police. And they also came back with a rather lengthy report concluding that that what had happened here was a serious violation of state ethics laws. So even if there was some inference that my clients were improperly motivated, I think that inference has been rebutted by independent sources who addressed this and came to the same conclusion. I hope that answers your question, Your Honor.
Well,
I want to just begin by pointing out that I also raised an argument of prudential standing in my brief. I'm going to stand on the brief on that just to point out, though, that
well,
Mr.
Since you have made an argument that has to do with standing and therefore with the court's jurisdiction, I do think we need to discuss it. And I must say I don't grasp the argument. Suppose MFS files a bid protest, and as a result, somebody among the defendants went out and shot the two plaintiffs dead. Would it be your position that only MFS could sue?
For First Amendment retaliation, I think so, Your Honor. It's not that there wouldn't be someone dead who could bring different causes of action, but I don't see. It seems to me now.
The usual rule is that the person who holds the right to sue is the person who was injured.
But it's also the usual. Let me just back up for a second from something I said in my brief. I said there was no injury in fact here in my brief. Mr. Baker has responded strongly against that. I'd like to withdraw that, suggesting there's no injury in fact. There is an injury in fact here. But it's also a rule that the person who gets to be the plaintiff has to be the person whose rights have been violated. Here we have an allegation that someone's speech was chilled. The only person that I can see here who has spoken is the corporation. They're very...
Sorry, the only people involved are the plaintiffs. The corporation is just a nexus of contracts. It's a way through which people work. But as the old saying goes, it has no soul to damn and no body to kick. It's just a collective noun for the people who are involved in it.
If the court believes that, then I think that argument has to fail, Your Honor. And I wanted to bring to the court's attention what I thought was an argument that needed to be addressed, which is the plaintiffs here are not really the speakers, or they're not the speakers in form. Now, if the court's going to say that they're the true speakers, then I think the standing argument falls. Then we have
they're
to
the
move.
Only people.
Well, yes, but corporations can speak too, and corporations have had First Amendment rights found to be violated. So
people have First Amendment rights, which they may exercise through corporate form. That's actually part of the First Amendment, the right to peaceably assemble. Justices keep saying that the right of assembly is the right of collective speech. That's how corporations come to have rights, but it's derivative from real people's rights.
Then the argument will fail, Your Honor. And I'd like to turn to the second argument, the qualified immunity argument. There's two parts to this. One is whether or not there is a constitutional right here, and the second is whether reasonable public officials would have recognized that right at the time they acted. My clients are happy to have won summary judgment, but they feel that they won it on the second prong, and they should have won it really on the first prong, because they don't believe there was a right here that the plaintiffs enjoyed when they spoke out this way.
Would the reasonable public servants include Mr. Sheppo?
He's a defendant, I think so, Your Honor, yes.
Regardless of his role, I'm obsessed with Mr. Sheppo.
Mr. Sheppo is on record as wanting this bid to be put to the general bidding process. He said, at least in the report that I read this morning, and I think there's deposition testimony to it as well, he was not in favor of sole sourcing this. The others were, and he went along with that. But Mr. Sheppo's involvement is different, I agree, than the other defendants in that he's been alleged to be this comparable employee who was treated differently. But he's also entitled, I think, to the benefit of looking to the internal affairs investigation report and the legal department's report, which both concluded that there were serious violations of ethical conduct by the plaintiffs. If he was also guilty of ethical violations, I don't see how that necessarily affects the analysis as to whether the plaintiffs in this case had a personal...
Well, why should he be shielded by Pickering? In other words, let's say everyone else is. Why should he be shielded under his circumstances? I mean, the conflict of interest, is in... it's in neon lights. It just blinks at you that he had.
I don't think the Pickering balance, though, looks necessarily to his motivation. It looks to theirs. The state in general is the actor here.
A state official can't retaliate against an employee merely because he doesn't like the employee's speech and then hide behind the Pickering balance and qualified immunity. And that isn't that what Mr. Sheppo is doing?
We don't agree with that. No. I don't believe there's evidence here that Mr. Sheppo has done those things. The allegation has been made, but I don't see any evidence here. The Inspector General's report, which is the only thing they really rely on, if you look at it, the very first page says very clearly, this is not evidence. It really is just the opinion of the authors of the report.
Of course, if you look at the last page, which I won't take up your time doing, but it certainly does talk about, Mr. Sheppo and the fact that he didn't truthfully disclose information when asked about it, and, pretended to have forgotten that he was president of FQS, and other such rather bizarre behavior.
Well, I mentioned earlier that there's some insulation here because the legal department had written the report and also the internal affairs, but also the discipline, which is the subject of this litigation, which is what they call the retaliation here, was not imposed by any of the defendants. Ultimately, it was the Director Trent's decision to impose discipline. He had all the facts in front of him, including the Inspector General report, and decided that Mr. Sheppo was not someone who should be disciplined for this.
That's stunning. But okay.
But he's not a defendant, Your Honor, and he's not really been named as having done anything wrong here. So that does also go to show I believe Judge Easterbrook's hypothetical, the government had made a decision.
Mr. Sheppo is a defendant.
Mr. Sheppo is a defendant, but Director Trent is not.
Okay.
And Director Trent is the one who imposed the discipline here, not Mr. Sheppo. Now, I'm sure Mr. Baker will say, the director did that on the advice of Mr. Sheppo. That's not really very... It's probably true in a very theoretical way, but the director had far more than Mr. Sheppo's recommendation for discipline here. He had all the managers coming to him and saying that this was a serious matter that needed to be given attention, and the discipline was proper, and as well as outside sources, as I said. Touching on the Garcetti question... I know Garcetti is a practical inquiry. It seems like sometimes there's subjective concerns the court has as to whether the employees believe they're acting as citizens. Other times it seems as though the court's more interested in what a reasonable employee himself would do in that situation. It's my position that all organizations expect their employees to bring to their attention waste. And what is interesting here is that we don't just have any employee here. Mr. Wist and Mr. Chaklos were high-level scientists who were responsible for training. So it was sort of incumbent upon them to speak out when they saw waste. So to the extent that their speech was made at all, I think it should be considered as speech we would expect an employee to make. It's interesting that it was sent to Mr. Yokley, who was in the procurement office of ISP. So essentially they went to their supervisor and told their supervisors, or not their supervisors, but someone in the organization, and said this was improper waste. That's something we would expect an employee to do. I think we've already covered the Pickering balance. I think that's a very strong part of my argument. The government has very strong interest in preventing conflicts of interest, also secondary employment. That's really what this discipline was all about. And finally, I'd like to turn to the last prong of Saucier, which I think is particularly strong. As I said, we agree with the district court on this analysis. There was no case law at the time my clients acted, anything like this. This is a very unique and somewhat bizarre fact pattern where public employees claim their corporation should be able to speak and undermine the decisions of their supervisors. I don't think there's anything like this in the case law. Mr. Baker has essentially conceded that in his brief. So now we're left to the question of whether it would be obvious to employees in their circumstance at the time. And again, I direct the court back to the Bielorusky memo from the State Police Legal Department and from the Internal Affairs report, which was very lengthy, both telling them that what they were doing was something that was supported by the facts. These were attorneys, I think, at least with Mr. Bielorusky was an attorney. When he reported back to them, he didn't say, wait, we've got First Amendment speech concerns here, you have to stop, we need to consider this in a different way. Mr. Bielorusky didn't see this as a First Amendment problem. The Internal Affairs Division didn't see this as a First Amendment problem. And so from the objective standpoint of my clients, it's pretty clear that they were entitled to qualified immunity on the second prong. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I'd ask that the court affirm summary judgment. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Certainly. Anything further, Mr. Baker?
Yes. Thank you. A couple of points. It seems as though the defendants are arguing this point that, look, there were these independent analyses. There was the Division of Internal Investigations, and there was the ISP Chief Legal Office. Well, first of all, I disagree with the fact that they were independent. Second of all, this is something that this court has addressed in the Myers versus Hacera case. In the Myers case, the plaintiff spoke out after she had been told by the mayor not to do so. And the mayor, relying upon a report done by Internal Affairs, who said that she was insubordinate, turned around and suspended her for a period of 5 days. This court addressed the issue and essentially said, look, you cannot get around the balance shifting of the Pickering balancing.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. Thank you.
Taken under advisement.
Thank you.